Okie dokie out there. What is going on? We are live right now. Stephen Ignoramus in the house with another episode of Call Me Ignorant. The episode of this one is Concerned Citizens, and I'm here live with Hannah Cox right now. Hannah Cox is a libertarian conservative writer, commentator, and activist, and she is a Newsmax insider and contributor to the Washington Examiner. Found her stuff online on Twitter, and it looked really interesting because some of her blog posts and some of her different articles and things like that. So really good to have you on today, Hannah. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So it's your first time on the program. So the first thing we usually do is just get people's story and stuff like that. So it says a writer and an activist. Which one did you start doing first?
I guess activism. I was not somebody who was really trying to get into politics or into political writing. I was actually working in the music industry in Nashville at the beginning of my career. And I was bored out of my mind. I really didn't like it very much at the end of the day. And I stumbled into political work. I started working for a group called the Tennessee Firearms Association that was sort of a group formed at the state level to do what the NRA says it's going to do. And really fell in love with activism and with working around policy and just felt called to get more involved. And so my career path kind of started moving in that trajectory. And I ended up leaving the music industry a couple of years later and going into politics full time. So that's really where my work started. And then writing came really quickly after that, because that's a medium that I love. I love to communicate through writing. I think that it's a really fantastic way to educate people. And so that's also been a big part of my work ever since.
Cool. Yeah. And so I didn't even expect this, but I'm a professional musician myself. What did you do in Nashville when you're in the music industry, if you don't mind sharing?
Sure. Well, it was pretty wide ranging. I went to Belmont University in Nashville, which is a really big music college for people who aren't familiar with it. It's right on Music Row. And throughout your college experience, you don't really get a normal college experience. You're interning on the row, you're producing. I was running an organization on the campus that actually staffed all of the award shows and red carpets. And so I was helping people assign with artists and get them through their radio remotes, get them through the red carpets. So I was kind of doing PR. I interned with Taylor Swift's management first, and then with her record label, Big Machine, with their A&R. I then did some publishing internships with Cobalt and with Big Loud Shirt, which is Craig Wiseman's company that's gotten pretty big in recent years. And then when I graduated, I kind of had all that in my background. So I'd really been in the work for a good 3 years. And I went to work for a company called Entertainment One, which is a huge global company. They actually do a lot more TV and film than they do music, but they do have music offices in Nashville and New York City. And so I started off with them doing events, also doing a lot of their PR and helping get their artists through their award shows and things like that. And then finished doing licensing. So I was placing songs in TV, film, anything to get sync money.
Cool. Wow. That's great. Can you say the name of that Tennessee, the thing that, you know, was trying to do what the NRA does, and how, in what way do you think the NRA is not doing their job?
Yeah, it was the Tennessee Firearms Association. Okay. And when I found it, like I said, I didn't have a political background at all. And I actually was considering going to law school is how I found it. And there was an attorney who ran the organization, and he wasn't doing a lot of work outside of that as well. And I thought, well, if I can work alongside him and kind of see what his day to day looks like, I'll know if I like law school or not. And so that was how I got involved with them. And he was really instrumental in helping me kind of along my path to ideology. He gave me The Law by Bastiat. And he really started showing me what the policies looked like. You know, we can sit here and talk Second Amendment policy all day and say we champion it, but watch what these organizations are doing behind the scenes. And he had formed the TFA about 25 years prior because the NRA was not doing the job they say they are. And so I saw very quickly that he was right about that. You know, not only were they not really pushing good bills at the state level, they actually were blocking really good state bills at this at that level frequently.
Wow.
And on top of that, you know, they really weren't weighing in equally on all Second Amendment issues. You'll find that they're very selective when they get involved, where they get involved, what they say, who they support. And so it was something that I got very passionate about and continue to be. I think that there's a lot of people who support the Second Amendment, giving a lot of money to organizations that tell them they're doing one thing and don't actually do it, who misuse funds, who don't defend all people equally. You know, to me, as somebody who's really cared about racial bias at the hands of our government, I never see some groups weigh in when we see Black people's Second Amendment rights violated in this country. And so that was something that really bugged me. So I worked for them for about a year. I was still working in the music industry full time during that. I was doing the TFA on the side. So it was a really good kind of crash course for me. on politics. It also was a fundamental time for me to develop my worldview because since I hadn't studied this, and since I hadn't really been paying that close of attention to politics, I'd grown up kind of just traditional Republican. I had, you know, a very team mentality. I really didn't know very much about policy. I didn't really know very much about why I believed what I believed. And so The Law by Bastiat was a great door that opened for me. And I started really reading a lot more about economics. And also, as I was traveling with that group and speaking to different chapters that they had across Tennessee, and talking to Republicans, a lot of the things that I was hearing were things that to me were not my belief system. You know, I was hearing a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment. I was hearing a lot of things that I didn't consider to be limited government at all. And what eventually sort of grew into the Trumpism ideology. And that really kind of bothered me and made me go do my digging and figure out where I stood. And what I realized was that my beliefs really didn't change, but that the GOP often didn't actually tout limited government, free market, individual liberty policy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's so my next question is kind of like, I've seen, you know, you sent over that you're a libertarian conservative. Did you, I don't know, did you think about saying conservative libertarian? Like what made you put libertarian first rather than conservative?
Well, I think libertarian is currently a bit more well-defined in America. I think we're losing our terminology in this country where things just don't mean what they actually mean. Words are losing their meaning. It's actually a very big problem, in my opinion.
Huge,
But, you know, I think conservatism, when you say you're conservative right now in this country, I don't know what you mean, right? You could mean a very wide range of belief systems and policy positions, whereas I think libertarianism is a bit more well-defined. Personally, if I could use anything to describe my views, I would say I'm a classical liberal. And I think that's the traditional usage of my school of thought. It was accepted as the definition for many, many years. That term liberal was co-opted by the left in this country and has been used to mean very illiberal things. And so it's just a problem that we have in the modern era of communicating what we believe and why. And I think that that also contributes to sort of the team mentality and why people don't recognize when the teams are moving, because we don't have very good definitions of who's where and what camps believe what. And there's a lot of kind of intermixing that goes on.
Yeah. So were you raised with, guns in the household? Did you take gun classes? Was that part of your culture before you got involved with that first organization?
Yeah, we always had guns in the house. I'm from Alabama. It would be weird if we didn't. And it was something that I knew about when I was a little kid. Like, I was shown where the guns are. You don't touch these are dangerous, blah, blah, blah. Like, never, ever, you know, and it was very common. And then when I got to be a little bit older, like, we would go shoot at a range, you know, sometimes my brothers were far more into guns than I was growing up, but definitely we were always raised around them. We're taught how to use them, how to be, safe with them. I really wasn't that into carrying myself until I started working for the TFA. And, you know, I was a young girl. I was like 24, 25, and I was going and speaking across the state of Tennessee, largely to older people. And I was like, they're going to laugh me out of these rooms if I don't really know my gun. So I went and got my permit to actually start carrying at that point. I bought my own gun and started carrying. And so like, I kind of came into making that more of a less of an ideology and more of something I was practicing. And through that became very passionate about getting other women to carry, because I think as a woman, that is one of the big women's rights issues in this country. That's the only thing that makes you equal to a man. That's the only thing that actually guarantees your safety. I've lost friends to domestic violence. I've lost friends to other violent crimes. And I think a lot of them could have been saved had they been carrying. And so it's something I'm very passionate about.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that makes, what you were saying earlier about the labels and stuff, I completely agree with. And it's very hard to, like, the second you say a label, there's a million people saying why it's not. It's the whole thing's a mess. But I've always thought that how can you be a feminist and anti-gun? That makes no sense, just based on what, like, to your point just there. But yeah, it makes no sense. And it's great to see someone kind of advocating for that. What about when you said you were brought up kind of traditional Republican? What was was your family into going to war with other countries? Were they not into, like, what type of, like, neocon conservative? What type of thing there?
Yeah, I would say leaning a bit more towards that. Yeah. There were certainly no, you know, qualms with, you know, the George Bush presidency in my household.
Okay.
And that was definitely my ideology as well. Like, I remember my at college at Belmont in 2008, we actually were hosting a debate between McCain and Obama.
Wow.
And so I was paying a lot of attention to that race. And I loved John McCain at the time. Like, I think I had a party for him in my dorm room.
Amazing.
It's really embarrassing now. But yeah, I mean, I was definitely like an interventionalist. But like I said, like, it wasn't even so much that I was thinking it through. It was just sort of like anywhere the GOP went, I was there. Like, and what's funny now is so many people assume Ron Paul, like I'm a Ron Paul convert. They're like, your guy, Ron Paul. And I'm like, y'all don't even know. I hated Ron Paul in 2012.
Wow.
Like, I was one of those people that was like, why won't you guys just fall in line? We have to defeat Obama. You know, it was very, just didn't get it. Didn't see the differences between a Romney and a Paul. Could not understand why people were making such a big deal over it. And so I really came to libertarianism very differently than I think a lot of people did.
Yeah. I mean, if you are, it's a long time ago, but like Ron Paul is basically on a pedestal, and I love Ron Paul. I'm not really a libertarian. I still have my LP card. I think I'm going to cut it up on stream. That's a different story or whatever. But you know, Ron Paul, I love, and that's, you know, you don't just put that on Twitter. I mean, if you say you're like, I'm sorry. Like, I like him now. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's very, very interesting. So when are you a member of the LP? Like, do you have a, are you small L, big L libertarian, but do you have a party that you're, that you like?
I don't.
Now? Okay, good.
And I don't really like parties, right? I'm kind of in the camp of George Washington, that the spirit of parties is something that should be guarded against. You know, if the Libertarian Party puts up good candidates and that's the best person in the race that's closest to my views, great. If not, you know, I look for the person that I think is the best champion of limited government free markets. I think that I'd rather judge somebody based off of the policies they tout versus the letter next to their name, because the letter next to their name could mean anything. I just don't trust that kind of labeling system. And I really wish we had a ton of parties in this country, or even no parties at all. I think it's something that allows people to not think and not really pay attention to policy and see what the person's actually doing. It prevents us from holding them accountable. And I think it's because we have an uneducated populace on this issue, right? Like, it's really easy to pick a team, stick with it, and vote for those people and feel like you're doing your duty. You're not. You need to actually be paying attention to the real policies they're pushing, what the effects of those policies are. Are they actually doing what they say they're doing once they're in office, and hold them accountable? And so I kind of find myself politically homeless these days. And I think that's perfectly all right.
Cool. Yeah, I saw the art behind you on Twitter says tribeless. So I guess that's maybe, cool. When did you start getting into, for lack of a better word, writing at like a higher profile level, like contributing to Examiner and things like that?
Well, I've always loved to write, like I said. I actually, before I moved into politics full time, while I was still working in music, I took about 2 years after I started working for the TFA. I was still working in the music industry at Entertainment One, and I kind of just took 2 years to build my resume on the side, to learn more, to figure out exactly where I wanted to be. It was important to me to not just go into politics to be into politics. I'm not trying to be in politics because I think it's cool, because I want to be in proximity to power. I have an ideology I'm trying to advance. I have policies I want to see take place, and I'm not going to work for just anybody or anywhere. And so I took my time. And during that time, I actually launched a coalition blog with a friend of mine called My Justice. This Just Plus Us Justice. And we actually were focusing on getting young libertarians to write, and young conservative, principled conservative writers. And so we did that for about 2 years and had a good run at it. I ended up letting it go when I did move into politics full time with a full time job, just because I didn't have the bandwidth. But that was when I really started writing more actively and more publicly, and using social media to kind of share those publications. And then when my first job in politics was with the Beacon Center of Tennessee, which is a free market think tank. And so we also had a publication. So I was writing there pretty significantly. I was writing for local papers in Tennessee quite often. But when I took my current role, which is running a group called Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty, I really stepped into a type of role where I was more of a spokesperson. And so that up the ante in my media work. I started writing for Newsmax as an insider, and things have kind of just built from there.
Cool. So you mentioned free market earlier. Like, what level of free market are you? I mean, because you have your anarcho-capitalists. I used to be one, complete, like, no government at all. But do you think there should be, what level of regulation or control of the economy do you think has a place in the government?
Yeah, I really think the government should exist to protect and enshrine rights. Yeah. And so if you see, you know, I think my views are perfectly in line with our founding documents and intents and where our founders were. I think that I'm not an anarchist. I think maybe you could call me like a mininarchist. Mm-hmm. But I think that we need a court system. Yep. I think that we need a national defense system. I think we need some level of policing, though currently nothing like what we have currently. It shouldn't look that way at all. And so I think that there is a place for government, but it needs to be severely restrained. And I don't think that central planning works. And so when people say, you know, we need the government to regulate this and regulate that, there's always unintended consequences to that. Yeah. That's not what we need. I think the free market can manage and regulate itself. I think that people can influence the free market to what needs to change and what needs to be produced. And I think, honestly, if you look back through our history, you know, so many people want to credit government for regulations that protected people or that, you know, fixed other issues in our society, when in reality, if you dig down to what was going on in the economy right now, those things were righting themselves. It might not have been at quite the speed, but they will, I think the market will respond. And so I'm almost a free market absolutist. I'm trying to think if there's any like caveats to that, but not that are coming to mind at the moment.
Right. Yeah. What I don't have my mind made up is on is the international stuff, definitely domestic, but it's like, I don't know if the word is protectionism for it, but some level of like, we aren't required to accept everything from every country and we aren't required to deal with every, I don't know if that's a regulation thing or more of just a choices thing. I actually don't know who's in charge of whether we do business with a certain country. Do you know the answer to that? Like, who gets to choose whether we trade stuff with Ireland or China? Or do you know whose job
right.
that is?
Well, the government has become severely intertwined in those decisions, which I don't think should be the case. And I think both parties are increasingly moving in a direction of even more of that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's up to the people buying and selling. If you don't like the deal you're being offered by a foreign country or by a foreign company, don't take it. There's nothing that forces you to take that deal. That should be up to you. And, you know, we as Americans should be able to decide what we want to buy. If we want to buy a product from China, from Ireland, from any other country, we should be able to make that decision and buy the products that we want. So I wish the government were not nearly as involved as in trade as it is. And I think that that's largely a policy issue for some reason that people sort of like don't see as a free market problem. And it's like free markets and free trade are entirely intertwined. You can't have one without the other. That is a huge market infringement.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so your inability. I mean, I guess you could make the argument, you know, if we're at war with a country, you know, if we're like in a really, really like violent struggle or just a trade war that the government, it might be the right decision for them not to allow it. But I don't really feel comfortable with that, to be honest. I don't really feel comfortable with the government having their hands in any pockets, really. So I don't know. One thing that me and the people that watch the show have talked about lately is the idea of private courts. Do you think that the government should have the monopoly on courts, or do you think private courts would be a decent idea?
No, you know, as much as a free market absolutist as I am, I think there are some institutions that need to be exempted from market forces. Market forces are a really good thing in almost every area. But when you get into a couple different areas, which are the areas where we do need government, you don't want market incentives because they're incentivizing towards profit. That's a good thing mostly, except for when we're talking about areas where there should be impartiality. And so I'm not in favor of private prisons at all. I'm not in favor of private courts. I think that the judicial system is absolutely one that government should be in control of, and that we should all have the ability to influence through our votes. So I'm not quite there. But just to circle back briefly to what you mentioned about, you know, foreign intervention when it comes to tariffs and things of that nature, I think it's also important for non-interventionists to really think about trade in that context, because it is something that we have used as a tactic in so much of our foreign policy. And what we do is we come in and oftentimes we use trade punitively to harm countries who we don't like. And what that then creates is economic upheaval, refugees, people trying to get out of our country, and then you have people trying to come here. All of it is interconnected. And so that's why we need to be principled in how we look at it, right? I'm a very pro-immigration person. Extraordinarily pro-immigration person. But to those people who are not, I think it's really interesting that you're okay with us creating climates that force people to need to leave their countries due to economic persecution is what it ends up being. And then you're mad when they try to escape. And so I think you have to really follow the line of what our intervention, what our actions result in, and it results in many undesirable other problems that occur from that.
Right. That's interesting. I mean, that's what, you know, another thing that me and my people over here have been saying is that it just sounds like kind of anything that's pro empire. It's just anything that like kind of hints at that, bases abroad, controlling prices of the planet. It just seems that if we could go back to being a country and a nation rather than an empire, a lot of these things might, you know, either fix themselves or be mitigated. That's a really good point. And, you know, I guess my solution, I think just any intervention, like get out of these crazy wars, stop, you know, I don't even know how it works, though, because under Trump, it's been a lot of the pen, you know, the stuff with China, you know, like, so I don't even know how to fix it, because it just seems like this tidal wave of momentum, like you said, both parties are behind of increasing spending. You know, they're good with decreasing it if it's stuff they don't care about. But as soon as it's, you know, I think Trump has spent more than Obama up to this point, and up to the point of his first term. So just big government is an issue. Guns a big issue of yours, big government. Are there any others? Does all of it kind of point back to that, the fact that you're small government?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it does. You know, I think instead of looking at things as Republican, Democrat, we need to start looking at it as authoritarian, statist, collectivist versus individualism, limited government, really reducing the scope. And I think so often the problem is people are really pro limited government in the areas that they don't like or when it affects them, really pro big government when they want to regulate something or when it's being used against people who aren't on their team. And so it's, again, an inconsistency. We don't have a principled constituency, and we have so many problems that flow from that, and so many people excusing things that do infringe on those principles when it's their team, right? They don't hold themselves accountable, and that's something that really drives me absolutely bonkers. You know, when you have people talking about criminal justice reform, which I'm a huge, that's one of my top issues, and then putting people up that aren't pro-criminal justice reform. You have people talking about limited government and cutting spending, and then you have people putting very big spenders and very authoritarian type people up. And so it's just something where I think both sides talk out of both sides of their mouths, and what we end up getting is a constant momentum and trajectory that moves towards bigger government, more intervention, collectivism, and authoritarianism. And those are the underlying root causes of all problems.
Are there any people in Congress that you do like? Rand Paul, Thomas Massey, you know, like people like that?
Yeah, I think there's some admirable people in public
service. There's like three.
I could probably name you a few. No, I absolutely adore Justin Amash. He was one of the first politicians I started following. And he was also very instrumental in helping me form my ideology, because he's brilliant. And he really understands free market economics. And he really understands our founding documents and the Constitution. And so I appreciated that every vote he would take, he would post on his social media what was in the bill, why he was voting as he voted, how it wasn't or was constitutional or free market. And that real life application of principles helped me develop my own understanding and education. So he was a huge deal to me. Thomas Massey, I tend to like. He's a bit further right than I am on several things, but I do respect him as a politician. Obviously, I think the world of Rand Paul. I get really sick of criticisms of Rand Paul. I think that he has done more to advance free market, limited government ideology than pretty much anybody else in Congress. He's consistently advocated for those things, used his platform to educate, and he's been very strategic and smart about staying relevant in a GOP that is increasingly hostile to those ideologies.
Gotcha. So yeah, one final question about this before we move into some current event stuff, but what type of prison reform do you advocate for? Do you mean like nonviolent drug offense? Like what kind of charges? I mean, because we're in the kind of, the media loves to call these leftist communists or whatever, like anarchists or whatever. But, you know, like what? So a person that's an anarchist would let everyone out, like no rule of law at all. But like, what type of reform are you looking for there?
Yeah, I think it's interesting they keep calling these people who want communism anarchists.
It's crazy.
That is not it, hon. Like, I don't know where you're getting that.
Nice.
But again, you know, words don't mean anything anymore. And I think that's largely intentional. You know, in my primary work, I work to end the death penalty. And I focus on that so heavily because I think that One, it's ghastly what's happening in our government with the death penalty. And I think if you can get in front of most people and inform them of that, you actually see significant rapid change on this issue. But I also think the death penalty is important because it's something that opens up people's eyes to what's happening more broadly in our system. If you get it on the death penalty, you're going to start to get it on all the issues that flow beneath it. You know, it's kind of the worst of the system, but there's so much corruption and problems underneath it. And so that has led to a lot of work with Republicans across the aisle that I've gotten to do. And so that is where my focus has been. But if you were to ask me personally, you know, what I want to see, it would take me all day to tell you. I want to destroy our current system and radically rebuild it because it is so wrought with problems. I mean, and from the bottom up, it is just overrun with corruption, with bad incentives, with a lack of accountability and transparency for government officials, poor incentives. What that really traces back to is a problem with our laws because we have too many laws. We have over-criminalized things and activity. We have leaders who are not innovative and don't know how to, you know, find solutions that aren't carceral, which is really quite pathetic in my estimation. And so we have to really start first and foremost looking at reducing the number of laws we have. You and I probably commit a felony a day, given how many laws we have.
Probably doing it right now, to be honest. Like there's something going on. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm sure. Who knows? Like, and who could know? Because we have too many laws for people to even be informed of the laws. And it's not an excuse for you to not be informed of the law. That's still, you know, is no excuse for it. And so that is the largest problem. And I think when we talk about matters of criminal justice reform, we often don't point back to the state, largely state lawmakers who are passing these laws that are being enforced. You know, everybody wants to look at the federal system. There is a problem at the federal system as well, absolutely. But also a lot of the justice criminal issues are local and we don't hold those politicians accountable. We don't say, what laws are you getting rid of this year? How are you removing these punitive punishments? Why are these things that are nonviolent even criminalized in the first place? And then, you know, from there, we then go and look at how is our policing structured? We then go and look at how do we assign sentences for people? And so there's just such a vast problem with how we're doing things in this country. But I think, you know, I often say people look back 100 years ago and they ask, how did people let things happen, right? You know, you read about these horrors in history and you're like, how did they allow that? And I think that's what's going to happen with what we're doing right now in our justice system. In 100 years, your grandkids are going to look at you and be like, how did you let this happen?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I also think about, I mean, knowing you need a time machine, but I wonder what is going to get said to them by their grandkids. It's just history moves forward and like hindsight's 20, all these cliches and stuff like that. I was going to bring up current events right now, but since you brought it up, let's talk about, what is it? It's Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. So did you found that organization? Or you're the national manager for, or director?
Yes.
For it? Okay.
Yeah, no, I took over a little over 2 years ago. I didn't found it, but I know the people who did. It was founded in Montana in, I think, around like 08, 09 kind of era. And it was some conservatives who were working around their legislature. And as you'll so often see to this day, the legislature was considering a bill that was going to shorten the appellate process for death penalty trials. And they were like, what the heck? This isn't conservative at all. Like the death penalty isn't even conservative. You know, why aren't we advocating against this? And they sort of loosely formed Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty. And what they found was they actually had a lot of support. A lot of conservatives kind of started coming out of the woodwork and be like, oh yeah, I have an issue with this too, but I didn't know there were others. And it took off from there and it grew pretty rapidly. And in 2013, it went national, launching at CPAC. And so it's been an official organization working since that point in time. And we now have 15 different state chapters across the country. We've been heavily involved with two repeal campaigns that have been successful in under 2 years. We've seen, you know, over 10 states with Republican sponsored bills to repeal the death penalty over the past couple of years. About 60 Republican state lawmakers signed on as sponsors to those bills. And so the movement's quite quickly gaining momentum.
Okay. So you're completely opposed to the death penalty?
Yes. But I wouldn't say all of our supporters are. Everybody that is a supporter of ours or working around our organization wants to see the death penalty abolished.
Okay.
Now, some of those people have a ethical, it's always wrong, you know, morality stance on it. Others maybe think it's okay theoretically, but recognize the way our system is operating in practice is not okay.
Okay. So here's the kind of the first question I had about it, because like it's about libertarianism and being a libertarian on this, because it seems like neither answer are libertarian. Like, you could, if you have the death penalty, the state is putting someone to death. If you don't have the death penalty, there are certain people that do commit crimes that most people would say are worthy of the death penalty. Say someone does, for instance, the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter was sentenced over the weekend to a life sentence in life sentence without parole in New Zealand. That's taxpayers that have to fund that for the rest of his life. And so it seems like either turn is not very libertarian. You're kind of hamstrung. So what would you say, like, the by far the most common argument for pro death penalty is that now we have to pay for this person's room and board for the rest of their life? What do you say to that argument?
Yeah, we hear that a lot, but honestly, it's just uninformed. You pay a lot more to have the death penalty than you do to incarcerate somebody for life without parole. The reason you didn't see a death sentence in New Zealand, interestingly enough, is that we are the only Western country that still has a death penalty at all. Every other country has turned against this long, long ago, recognizing that it's quite antiquated and, like, I mean, frankly, just like really kind of barbaric and weird that we still do it at all. So the rest of the world doesn't do this, except for when you get into like places that have serious humanitarian violations. Like, so we're in the company of like Saudi Arabia, China, Iraq, Iran. Like, that's our company in carrying out the death penalty. But when people try to say that it saves money, you know, we know that the death penalty is the most expensive part of the criminal justice system on a per offender basis. We know that it costs at least 10 times more to have a death penalty case than it does to have a life in prison without parole case. We also know that the average person sentenced to death is never executed. They end up serving life in prison without parole anyways. Mm. So why is it so much more expensive? It should be equal, right? If you're sitting the same amount of time in prison. Good point. Yeah. The reality is that the trial itself is far more expensive than other trials. And that's because it's so much more comprehensive. So you have more hours worked by everybody involved, public defenders, prosecutors, judges, law enforcement, forensics. You're paying for more testimony, you're paying for more testing, on and on and on and on. So it adds up. And in most studies we've looked at least $1 million more than a life in prison without parole case. So 70% of the costs come at the trial level alone. And what we see is that since 2000, new death sentences have kind of collapsed. They're down about 60%. Most of the time when a jury has the option, they still pick life in prison without parole. And so that's money that taxpayers are spending largely for security theater to seem tough on crime. We know that the death penalty is not a deterrent. So that's not only ineffective money, that's wasteful money that we should be spending to actually solve more crimes or on programs that actually would work to deter crime in the first place. It's a gigantic opportunity cost. And we know it kills innocent people every year. And so when you look at the number of people that we risk killing, you know, there's been one person exonerated for every 9 executions. Hundreds of others have been released that are likely innocent and not fully exonerated. We know we kill innocent people. We know it's not a deterrent. We know it's a really expensive, wasteful program. There's nothing conservative about any of that or libertarian. You know, there's nothing limited government about it. There's nothing protecting individual rights or the sanctity of human life there. And there's certainly nothing fiscally conservative about it.
What about, I mean, just a quick hypothetical. I mean, I do hypotheticals all the time, but I also recognize that they're just people using their imagination. So, you know, what about if a person is like dead to rights on video doing the worst crime imaginable and everyone knows that they're for sure? I guess what I'm saying is, what about a more brutal system? like without a as speedy trial as possible. Everyone knows the person did it. It was like some terrible stuff with kids. What about that? Would you still be anti death penalty?
I would. And I think when people say that, I'm like, to me, that sounds as fantastical as a socialist society working. Like, what if we all held hands and
said
everything?
Yeah, that's why it's not gonna happen.
Yeah, our system doesn't work that way. We've tried to have every single person says they support the death penalty only for the innocent or only for those who are truly not innocent, only for the worst. We have tried to fix it to ensure the system operates that way. Mm-hmm. In the 1970s, the U.S. Supreme Court banned the death penalty because it was so biased and had so many wrongful convictions and was so driven on race. It came back a couple years later. States put in all these fixes that were supposed to make sure that was how it operated. We have over 5 decades worth of data now that shows it operates in the exact same manner. And we also know that there is, you know, people, when they say the worst of the worst, they typically do mean people who hurt kids or something like that. But it's an arbitrary kind of classification, right? Like, not everybody agrees on what that even is. But let's say we could agree on what that is. It's still not how the system's operating. The heinousness or nature of the crime has so little to do with who gets the death penalty. The number one driver is the location of the crime. 2% of counties in this country bring the majority of death penalty cases. And all executions since reinstatement have come from 16% or fewer of our counties. And so it's very based on the location. You very much see socioeconomic and racial statuses become heavily apparent in the sentencing of the defendant, but also in the race of the victim. We largely use it for white victims. You're much more likely to get it if you've killed a person who's white than if you've killed a person who's Black or Hispanic or of a different ethnicity. And the number one combination on people on death rows across this country is a Black defendant with a white victim. And so we're very specific where we use it, and it has really little to do with anything other than those drivers. And so I think it's utterly impossible to imagine a government, especially this government, being able to carry out matters of life and death in a way that is equitable. But even still, if I did think that, I would still be opposed to it because, you know, I'm a Christian and I believe that people don't lose their value as a human being because they've done something awful. I think everybody has the possibility of redemption. I think that I've seen, you know, people who have done terrible things turn their lives around and then be used very powerfully and do really amazing things. And so it goes against my human ethics to suggest that people should be disposable. And I think that when we have that stance that people are disposable, it then starts to infiltrate our views on other issues in the society where we don't truly value human life because we do see it as disposable unless it's perfect. You know, we even see that when a person is a victim, if they had anything in their record, even like stealing a candy bar, there's a large percentage of our society that will say, well, they deserved it. They had it coming. You know, they had done this in their past. That's a really big problem in a society.
Gotcha. I mean, one thing I just thought about was that if the Second Amendment is absolute, like it's supposed to be, it seems like a lot of the people that are committing those heinous acts, if there's someone around them that's allowed to protect them, could just get, you know, protected, you know, could just be dealt with on the spot if it's a home intruder or something like that. But I mean, I do see a problem. Like, I guess I do see a little bit of a problem with saying with not like using stats when you're talking about individuality. Like, I get that there's a certain, like you said, it's based on location. It's a certain races are affected more than others or whatever, but that doesn't change like the person's pain of this thing happening right now to a person they care about. And I know that a lot of people just want to see these people go. And I know a lot of these people would say that is Christian as well. There are parts of the Bible that are, you know, that are pro authority, that are pro, like, you know, righteous justice. And it's kind of interesting. How do you change people's minds? You know, is that a big part of what you do? Like, persuasion and advocacy? Like, what's your day to day in this organization?
Yeah, well, I would say on that subject, I don't change people's minds. I let the victim's family members speak for themselves. And what most people perceive as a large percentage of them wanting this is not correct. We have overturned the death penalty in two states in the past 2 years, like I mentioned, New Hampshire and then Colorado. And in both states, the amount of murder victims' family members who showed up in favor of getting rid of repeal was like 36-1. On the other side. And so when you actually start to talk to people who have been impacted by crime, you won't find these cookie cutter responses. And I think also, you know, there's a lot of people who weigh in on issues like this who've never been around the justice system, and they don't actually know the backgrounds or stories of people who are complicit in committing crimes or affected by crime. And it's not so black and white. You know, there's this idea that there's just some bad people and they wake up and they're just violent because they're bad and they go and commit crimes against these people who are just good and like innocent. And actually what you find is there's a lot of cyclical nature in violence. You know, people don't wake up and just become violent. Most of those people were first victims themselves. They're often family members of victims themselves. We see violence is very concentrated in certain communities and areas, and it is something that when people are a part of the system, they often play multiple roles in this system throughout their time. And so it's not a cookie cutter decision for them. And oftentimes, you know, when there is a homicide, you're more likely to be killed by somebody you know than by anybody else. So there's often people who are interrelated that are involved in these crimes. And so I think I used to have that perception too of, you know, if this were me, I would want this. And it's absolutely not what I find when I talk to them. And, you know, they have a very wide range of reasons they're against it. And there's a lot of nuance there. But many of them, you know, have different personal reasons for being against it, like I referred to a minute ago. But then also there's others who were maybe in favor of it and started the process and realized they were getting drugged through the mud by a political system to get a win for the prosecutor and being promised closure that never comes from this system. There's a lot more we could be doing for victims of crime and for their families that would actually help to heal and to actually help them find pathways forward that we're not doing because we're wasting so much money on this security theater that makes us feel good, makes us feel like we're doing something, getting vengeance, but actually isn't producing any safer communities or really focused on healing or focused on ending the cycle of violence.
Are there cases where you've seen people proven to be innocent that were on death row that were executed then afterwards proven or like false cases and stuff like that?
Well, most of the money goes into exonerating people before they're killed, which is a heavy lift. This isn't the system catching itself and letting these people out. This is mostly pro bono groups working really hard to come in and fight to prove innocence. Our system makes it really difficult to prove that you've been wrongfully convicted. There's a lot of arbitrary deadlines. They often will fight DNA testing. They'll block to get it introduced. They'll block new hearings. There's nothing about our system that is working to scrupulously check itself and make sure that we don't have people being killed wrongfully. And so that's where the dollars go, right? We're not seeing money going to looking through people who have been executed and seeing if they were innocent. We typically know when they kill people who are likely innocent and sound the alarm about it. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, every year there's been at least one or two cases that, of executions that I feel pretty confident the person was innocent. The evidence indicated they were innocent and they were still executed. So throughout our history, there's no way of telling how many. But again, if we've had one person exonerated for every 9 executions in this country, which is it's a tremendous feat to get something exonerated. I don't think people who aren't around the legal system understand just how difficult it is. You don't only have to have your trial reversed or in some way prove that, you know, you were wrongfully convicted. It's an additional step once that happens to really get fully exonerated. And so hundreds of other people, you know, take Alford pleas or have their cases thrown out in other manners, but aren't fully exonerated. So just given those numbers of innocence, we know we kill a lot of innocent people in the system.
Wow. Well, thanks a lot for the info on that. All your information is linked below in the show description. I think I'm going to put your organization in the chat as well for people to take a look at. But what other issues do you like writing about for Newsmax and things like that?
I think I like writing pretty widely. Like my Newsmax column is very focused on the death penalty and criminal justice reform, whereas at the Examiner, I tend to be a bit more broad. But I like educating people about free market principles, but in ways that aren't so like wonky. Because I think there's a very limited audience for people who like really want to come read about economics. Yeah. But I think if you do it in a way that relates to things people care about, then I think you have a lot more interest and you get a lot further. So, you know, recently I like to take things I see out in pop culture or just in my, you know, frame of reference and then work that into articles. And so one thing I kept seeing on Instagram was this like Insta slideshow people were posting about why billionaires are bad like, had all this just like absolute BS information in it. And so I wrote an article basically countering that and being like, this is not the problem with billionaires. You know, they're not hoarding the wealth. It's not a fixed pie of wealth. They're not the reason you don't have more money, but there is a problem with what we're doing in our economic system that relates to billionaires. Let's talk about cronyism. Let's talk about corporate welfare. Let's talk about how the system is rigged and you should be mad. Because for me, you know, where we need to gain ground on free market principles is with these people on the left who are more open to it, but they see problems in our system. You know, so often when I'm talking to like a Bernie Sanders supporter or somebody who's pretty far left of me, we don't usually disagree on the problems, but they're blaming something very different for the problems than what I see as the root cause of the problems. And so being able to help people kind of follow that rabbit hole down and be like, here's the root cause and it's government intervention, which is what you're kind of asking for more of in your like candidate political sphere. Let's think about this. I think that that's really powerful and it's interesting to people. And so I like to find ways to relate to people and draw them in. And I also have a really great editor at the DC Examiner. I have to say, like, oftentimes if I tweet something, he'll send me a message and be like, hey, you should really like expand upon that in an article. And I've gotten to write some pieces there that I would never have thought to make an article, but that ended up being really popular. Like I wrote one talking about how I regret my childhood crush on Elliot Stabler from Law and Order SVU. And
nice.
And he was like, you should expand upon that. And I thought, that's hilarious. So, you know, and through that, I got to talk about police brutality and about the kind of people we hire to be police and how there's not enough accountability. And so, and then, you know, that's the thing more people read because people know who Elliot Stabler is. So I like to do things like that in my writing. I find that to be more interesting for me to get to write in that way and tends to draw more viewers.
Cool. Have you done any pieces on like the lockdowns, the economic shutdown, things like that?
You know what? I actually have not written any full pieces on that. I've weighed in on social media from time to time. But I also, you know, I like to not run my mouth when I am not fully informed. And I am not a healthcare expert. I'm not someone who has spent much time studying some of these issues. I think, obviously, anytime there's a violation of civil liberties, I'm going to have an issue. Obviously, I disagree with a lot of what the government has been doing. And I think we're already seeing really bad ramifications from that. And so I have spoken out against that, but I think there's people who are more equipped and more educated on some of those issues who are doing a good job of that than I am. Mm-hmm. So I've been following a lot of people. You know, I think Young Americans for Liberty has been really outspoken and doing some great work around that. I think Jeff Tucker at AIER is doing some good work and advocating around that. So I've kind of actually taken a little bit more of a backseat on that topic.
Okay. But do you have any, like, do you oppose the lockdowns? I mean, not even about the actual virus stuff, but the, do you think, what do you, you know, just your quick take from the start, do you think that a certain level of lockdowns, economic lockdowns, is good, or would you have liked to see it not happen?
It should never have happened. And I don't think it was necessary. You know, I was in New York City. I had just moved there when this first started. So for March and April, I was in Manhattan at the, you know, in the eye of the storm. And what was happening even before the shutdowns were people were staying home. There was no reason, you know, to come in and do this. I actually was a proponent individually of flatten the curve when it was first, you know, the premise. And that made sense to me. I was in a place with 8 million people packed into a tiny area. There was a limited number of resources. We needed to make sure that they were able to treat the number of people they were going to have to treat. So I was fine with staying home. I'm in a job where I work remotely anyways. That wasn't a sacrifice for me. I think individuals want to do the right things. And I think if they're communicated clearly, people would have done that to the extent that they could. And I think that that would have been enough. And I think it was already happening. You know, the weekend before they announced the shutdowns, I was in Union Square getting some groceries, and it was a ghost town. For anybody who knows Manhattan and Union Square, this is a major area. And so it was absolutely unnecessary. It was punitive towards businesses. I think it was done under false pretenses. I think that they have continued to string these out far past the need to actually ensure that we had the resources to address the need. This has become something much bigger since then, but it was never necessary in the first place.
What do you think it's going to take to, I mean, like, I hate even asking this like it's a question, but do you think this is the new normal? Like, or, and for how long do you think this is going to last, and, you know, how do we do something about it?
I'm pretty cynical. I think that a lot of it will disappear with the election. I think there's a lot of people incentivized to continue this through the election. And I think that right now, you know, fearmongering is very powerful, and it really works on a lot of people. And so I've been in South Carolina since May. I escaped New York and fled down to a red state. but even though things have been open here, it's ghost town, man. Like, I'm the only person in my yoga class. I'm one of like two or three tables at a restaurant. Like, people are still choosing to stay in because they're scared. And I think the media plays into that. I think politicians play into that. I don't think we're getting clear communication. And so I think until something changes around the messaging, we'll continue to see people not going back to normal when they have the options to. And that also, I think, has a lot to do with the election. I think that those messages could change significantly post-November.
Yeah. I mean, also, I mean, there's been some silver linings in almost all, you can find a silver lining in almost anything, but like, I think that we've spent a long time, like, just making the president more and more powerful, in fact. And also, part of that has been in people's minds. Like you said, I think you made a mention about it earlier, where all of a sudden people just put so much stock up there. And I think this whole thing has, if you're a fan of decentralization like you and I are, it's been good for that, because now at least people are thinking on the sheriff level. They're thinking at a smaller level than the presidency. And it might take that to turn around. But also, it's proven that you can have tyranny on the local and state level, because I don't think, you know, economically Trump has done some stuff, but there's been no like federal lockdown. It's been at the state level and things like that. But I haven't seen too many localities. I've seen businesses, like you said, you're the only one in your class, two or three tables open. And I don't know. Do you think that really the economic stuff is going to, I mean, I think that the some of the virus numbers are going to go away after the election, but how do you reverse the spending thing? Because it's not just the virus thing. It's been a spending wave for decades. But do you think that's ever, what do you think is going to happen with the dollar? Let's just get straight to it. Do you think this is going to like implode one day? Are we just going to go new currency? What do you think is going to happen there?
I mean, it's, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know I'm not going to like it. Yeah. we're definitely heading off a cliff. I don't see any, you know, silver lining in that aspect in our future. As far as getting people to return to the new normal, you know, again, like, I think that that's a behavioral issue, right? And I don't know that we will get everybody. I don't know that we go back to 2019, right? Like, I think some things could look really different moving forward. And there are some silver linings in that. Like, you know, school choice was an issue I've always been very passionate about. I worked on in 2016, 2017, a little bit in 2018. And it was a very tough issue. You know, it was both sides attacking it at all times. People were always trying to protect their interests in that field. And now we see a tremendous amount of public sentiment turning towards it and people really talking about implementing that large scale. So I think that would be, school choice is one of the most important things for this country to pass. You know, we look at the problems that we have with not having an educated populace, and it's by design. We need people to be able to get out of these government schools that are failing, where they're trapped. That is imperative. If we want to have this republic continue, we have to get people out of these largely government propaganda machines. And so I'm really enthused about that possibility. I'm a huge proponent of remote work. I think that it greatly increases your quality of life. I get a lot more done. I get to see my family a ton more than I ever did before. I get to pursue hobbies and activities and creativity outlets that make me happy. I'm in better shape. I eat better. Like, I have so many benefits in my life from getting to work remotely. And it's something that all these companies have really, you know, held close to the chest and tried to prevent for so long. And I think that that is an argument they'll lose moving forward, because now that people have had a taste of it, they're going to want more of it. These are good things that could permanently change the way our society is structured, how we operate, how we relate to each other, how we do business. I don't think, you know, economically that we lose money in all of this. I think you're seeing a shifting in how we spend money and what types of businesses will succeed. That's kind of a beautiful thing. You know, I think that it's good to see innovation and growth in that way. But government needs to get out of it. It needs to quit picking winners and losers in this dynamic. Quit infringing on people's abilities to innovate and implement new changes that would help them survive in this new world. Those are all things that they're largely not doing. There was, you know, there was some good deregulation that came up front with COVID, where we saw some things, especially in our healthcare, get reduced and removed that have been needed to go for quite some time. So my hope that people take away from all of this is just how incompetent your government is, how incapable they are protecting you, how many things they do that reduce your ability to obtain good goods and services at a lower price, and push to keep these measures permanent, and push to increasingly not have government take over new industries. I don't know how anybody could look at the government's response to COVID and think, yeah, I want them running my healthcare.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. Yeah. You've got to be crazy.
All right, so I know you have a hard out at 1 o'clock. So last little thing I want to talk about before I get you to plug your work and tell people how to find you. You know, there's another kind of liberty authority thing, but you know, there's crazy stuff happening in cities right now. It's a bunch of destruction. Let's posit that we want the problem to be solved. If the mayor or the state isn't doing anything about it, you know, we've had this thing with the feds going into Portland and other places, and you know, the left complaining about how they're detaining people. As far as I'm concerned, there's only three options. There's it come from private means, you know, private gun owners, local authorities, or federal authorities. How do you, you know, some people have said that the federal government shouldn't do anything and we should, you know, push these cities into the ocean, you know, like, so what would be your, like, you, like, because it's like, they're not protecting themselves. Why should the federal government fix them? They're not letting gun owners do what they want to do. So it's just like ends in fire. So how would you fix the rioting destruction of property issue?
Well, how I would fix it is actually reforming police so they don't kill innocent people or shoot black men in the streets anymore. Yeah. That would be number one.
Okay.
I think so often we're letting our focus get taken off the real problem here, which is state violence against our people. Mm. The last thing we need to do to squash what's happening is use more state violence against our people. Okay. So when people talk about like sending in the like military against our own people, I mean, I think that's really creepy and bizarre that that's your solution. That's your go-to. That seems super extreme. I have a huge problem with the fact that police aren't doing their jobs in these cities right now, right? Like, you know, they want to say that they shouldn't be defunded. They want to say that we should put more trust in them, give them more money. Why can't you handle this? I don't know if it's intentional or what's going on there, but I think that's a really weird factor to me. You shouldn't have 17-year-old kids running around thinking that they're the police. The police should be doing their jobs. I also think largely, you know, being a part of the movement that's for police reform, that's for criminal justice reform, that's for anti-racist work, I really do think that there is a messaging problem here. Like, the movement needs to do more to disassociate with people who are rioting. But the fact is, it is still a very small percentage of people involved in this movement that are behaving that way. And I don't think most of the people out there rioting are a part of our movement. I think they're people who have other grievances. Maybe they're economic. Maybe they're bored because of the shutdown. Maybe they're just people who, you know, want to riot to cause issues. I don't know, but this is no longer something that is really based in the criminal justice reform work. And so I think that we need to disassociate from that. I think police need to do their jobs. And I think we need to refocus on the real problem here, which again is state violence.
Gotcha. All right. Well, thank you so much for your input on all this stuff. And this is going to upload as a podcast, I think, in about a week or something like that. And people can catch the replay and stuff like that. So just tell people where they can find you online. All the stuff is linked below in the show description. But if anyone wants to check out your work, why don't you tell them where to find you?
Cool. So I'm at Hannah Cox 7 on Twitter. I think I'm at Hannah Danielle Cox 7 on Facebook. ConservativesConcern.org is the website for the organization that I run. And we also have social media presence as well. So if you want to get connected, hit me up at one of those places.
All right. So Hannah Cox, everybody, all the information is down below in the show description. Hope you guys have a nice day and be on the look for this podcast uploading later. Have a good